This is Raphonics After Hours.
Hello. Welcome. Rack Addicts After Hours time once more. This is a music and technology podcast. You've got Ben here, you've got Pete, and it's my delight to welcome another illustrious guest in our series of the only two interviews we've ever done. We have with us today Finn from Stochastic Instruments. Phineas de Thornley Head, the wonderful man sitting on Zoom in front of me. You may know him as Headcell. From performances with the Super XLs, perhaps, or maybe even the Modular Research Group leader from DBS Music. As I mentioned before, Stochastic Instruments, one half, with the good doctor Stuart McVeigh. Most importantly, however, I believe you're a Genesis fan.
Oh my goodness, how did you know that?
Yep, I did some internet stalking. We'll get back to that later. So, we do always start off our little weekly somethings with a catch-up. Pete, I believe you've been up to something. What have you been up to?
Yes, I've been at that website that should remain nameless.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
The danger of modular grid.
Yes, exactly. It's one that I tend to steer away from because I just get befuddled with especially nowadays, with the amount of modules that are available. Yes, it's a place I dare not go, but I've had to.
You'd probably have to have a premium account to fit the moth on there, wouldn't you?
Possibly. I haven't tried to model the moth in it. I don't think they've got... I don't know how you could construct it. Could you make a case that sort of size? It's an irregular size.
Yeah, I think you're limited by row number until you pay, which works quite well. So if you're Colin Benders, obviously you're practically funding the entire website, I think.
So I don't even know how many HP the moth is. It's a funny size. I thought it would work, and there isn't some gaps I can't get rid of because they're half an HP or something like that.
For people unfamiliar with the modular world, this question might sound a bit strange. You were sliding nut man.
No, strips.
Good. Strips all the way.
Yeah. So I've been trying to design the live system, as we've discussed on a couple of previous podcasts.
And it's grown.
Yes. It started out at two rows of 84 HP, and unfortunately, it's grown another row. So
a familiar story.
Yes. That is going to be it. That is the absolute limit.
Yeah, that's a familiar phrase as
well. Yes. No, it will be. It will be. It's just that I couldn't quite get all the functionality I was trying to get into the one case with just the two rows, unfortunately.
Yeah. Were there a few key offenders that made it stretch?
Yes, the Hex Mix and the Endorphins Queen of Pentacles.
Gotcha. So instead of the, was it 808 flavour of the Black Noir, and then that's 909 and samples, is that
yes,
the way
that's correct.
Went?
So yeah. I'm still debating, but I'm leaning towards the Queen rather than the Black Noir.
Gotcha. Portable case, obviously, but will there be any potential for battery power?
No, not specifically, involved with the case as such. I will get one of those leisure batteries that we discussed previously.
Yes.
So I believe Amazon seems to have quite a range of them. So it'd be one of those, as long as it's got sufficient power to either power the case, any of the other items I choose to bring along when we next have some sort of live session.
We're in the presence of a seasoned modular performer. I saw some big nods down there.
No, I'm actually particularly interested in talking about the leisure batteries because modular busking was something I wanted to do sometime before lockdown, and of course COVID hit. I had exactly the same idea. You just go onto Amazon, find an appropriate kilowatt hour leisure battery and sort of see if it would work. I mean, I suppose the danger is, of course, modulars are quite expensive, so it takes a little bit of bravery to sort of put one of those directly on the plus and minus 12 line.
Well, no, it's fine. Just bring a 19-inch power conditioner with you, and then it's still totally portable.
Yes. But no, that's fantastic. How far have you got with it?
What, in respect to building the new system or the leisure battery?
Well, the integrating the leisure battery in.
Well, we've been discussing it for quite some time because one of the things that Ben does or has been doing for quite some time is he is one of the founder members and organisers of a thing called the Modular CAF. The best analogy, and there are a few about, it's a bit like the old school computer clubs back in the day.
Oh, how wonderful.
Except it's modular. A group of like-minded people sort of shuffle into a premises once a month or so and demonstrate their wares.
Attracts all sort of excellent characters. It's great fun.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
We had one outdoor show before the pandemic was an issue, and one when it was, and that weird semi-opening that we had recently, and we're planning another. That's the cause for Pete's acceleration into the portable world.
Well, please let me know how that goes, because that sounds exactly the kind of stuff I was interested in. It's a thread I want to pick up as well.
The batteries that I've been looking at are... I wouldn't be too concerned about them potentially damaging the equipment. They seem to be designed for charging laptops and phones and that type of thing. I mean, I should actually correct the terminology, because officially a leisure battery is a large lead acid battery that you normally put in a caravan. But these are, I mean, I don't know how to describe them.
They're just like the giant portable battery banks that have taken over the world. So lithium polymer, maybe, just lots of them. I know one of the modular CAFAs uses one that's called an OmniCharge, which just has a UK 3-pin on the end, and then it's kind of a cylinder roughly that size, and that he uses with an Octatrack just fine. That gets him a good couple of hours on it.
And how big is his rig?
That's just Octatrack,
right,
and nothing else.
But anyway, yeah, there's a range of these batteries. They typically have a 5-volt USB or several 5-volt USB outlets. They'll have maybe a 12-volt outlet, and then they'll have a 13-amp socket as well.
I've got another battery-powered nugget to intersperse more in the news section, so we'll come back there in a bit, I reckon.
And as well as spending quite a lot of time on modular grid, I've also managed to order a flight case for the Novation Summit in preparation bring that into the outside world as well.
Sounds good.
So that's been my week, basically.
Lovely. Is there any planning on the case front? Are you buying a case, building a case?
Well, I was building a case, but if it goes to three rows, I haven't got enough components in stock, so I might just default and buy one, take the easy route out.
Fair enough. Well, Finn, we don't so much get an update as potentially we could have your entire life story since you haven't been a guest before. But yeah, what have you been kicking about with recently? Modular stuff, general life things, whatever you want to chat about that's interesting.
Life things, picking colours for the living room, and wonderfully...
Getting familiar with those Pantones.
Very much so. Wonderfully being able to work in the garden, has just been great. Partially having had our bomb site that was our garden for about 8 years, finally done. They finished doing the patio, and then it promptly rained with storm force winds for 2 weeks. And finally, the sun started to shine. So we got the furniture out and put the laptop out there, and it's just been palatial. So that's been fun. Modular wise, I suppose first and foremost, still trying to get our way through the last of the waiting list of the first batch of people that wanted one over 2020. And we're really getting quite close to the end of that, which is very exciting. And trying to dovetail that into some new stuff that Stuart and I are thinking about.
Ooh, spoilers. We'll come
back
there.
It's all very top secret. But there are a few things that we hope to bring out over this year, which are
good news.
Kind of a lot of emailing and a lot of planning. So mostly plate spinning, I think, like all of us do.
In the multifaceted life of a music, digital something, engineer extraordinaire.
It's nothing if not varied.
Always the way, and the best way. Variety is the spice of life, as the phrase
far
goes.
Far better busy than bored.
Absolutely. I do want to jump into the Genesis Avenue, if I may.
Please do.
I actually can't remember where or how I found out. Maybe... Wait, no, you just emailed us anyway. That
wasn't
some
creepy
stalking. Did I
actually comment on the information? I've completely forgotten.
the big question, of course, is have you got tickets?
I did, yes.
Excellent.
To the O2.
Whenever it is now, I don't
they
know.
They shifted it, I think it's mid-October, because we're going for the last one.
Cool.
Or the last British one. I think they're off to America then.
Gotcha. Nice one. Have you seen Genesis before?
I have. Many years ago, in 1992, in Nebworth, which was the first... It really was the first big rock concert I ever went to.
What a way to start.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just wonderful. Genesis was, in fact, the very, very first album I ever bought.
Ooh, which one? I'm going to judge you quite harshly on this one if it's the wrong one. Or the wrong
one.
There's plenty
if
of
If I say I'm
ones.
44, see if you can work it out.
Actually, Pete's better with the years than I am. But is that going to be early Phil?
No, a little later than that. But for reasons I'll explain, actually. It was mid-80s, and it was Invisible Touch. I sort of went back and forward from there.
Yep, that's the way I went as well.
I had initially a fairly strict musical upbringing. We didn't listen to rock music or any such thing in our house. That's changed radically.
Ooh, none of these electric
guitars.
Certainly not. No.
And I begged my parents for a personal stereo for my... whatever it would have been, my 10th birthday, because it was 1986, and they relented and they bought me one. And a well-known pharmaceutical company who I probably can't name, but also used to sell albums and personal stereos and cameras and things. And they had a deal whereby you got one of the top 40 for free when you bought one of these. So I was sort of sent off to go and find one that looked good. I was brought up in a religious household, so I just picked the one that I recognised the name of. So I bought Genesis. And I played it to my parents, and they massively approved. They thought, goodness me, this is fantastic. So it sort of went from
excellent.
There. And then I kind of went back, because, of course, there wasn't another one until We Can't Dance in whenever it was, 91. So I could only go back from there, and bought Foxtrot. And to this day, I think Supper's Ready is really one of the great masterpieces of post-war music. I'd more than happy to go on record and put that up there with Michael Tippett and Steve Reich and all my other heroes. I just think it's such a magnificent piece of music.
No, you're absolutely right. It's incredible.
I actually arranged it for a piano and all band when I was a sixth former. So we did the first half of Supper's nice. Ready to a completely bemused hall of parents.
Is that not the prog rock way?
I think it probably is, yeah. I mean, if 100, if even 50% of people know what's going on at the time, it's going to be far too popularist.
Excellent. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but that's Nebworth in 92. They are doing a Record Store Day pressing with something from that show this
are
year.
Are they? Wow.
I think it's that show, and I've already planned my morning to go and try and seek that out before I head off on
wonderful.
Holiday. I'll have to check that later, but that's definitely the show.
Oh, brilliant. No, many happy memories. It's going to be fantastic.
Wonderful stuff. We're going to dig into some Stochastic Instruments related things soon, but let's rattle through the news because there's nothing massive, but there's some cool nuggets. Pete, did you manage to pick anything up this week? Because I've got a sort of five-ish to have a look at quickly.
No, I haven't seen it. Too busy looking at Modular Grid.
Oh, yeah. You've been tunnel visioned in there. Well, I do use Modular Grid as a little bit of a news source, potentially. So if we start there, we were talking about Chaos Devices last week, I think. They've refreshed the Moskva. I hope I haven't butchered the pronunciation on that one, but that's their spirally eight-step circle sequencery boy. Moskva 2 and Expander. Sort of more of the same kind of ethos as the original, but I believe the additions now are that you can go sort of zoom in per step and have up to kind of 256 steps in total if you kind of zoom in and out. But this extra resolution per step will give you strange timings, swing. I think there's going to be ratcheting in there and all that kind of stuff. And the expander will give you CV over lots of parameters. The original never grabbed me, but I'll wait for some demos and see if the new functionality makes it exciting. So it's Moskva 2 and the expander is called Ostankino. I'm bad with these foreign words that I don't want to mess up. ADAC system are up next. They've got one that rolls off the tongue. It's the 503 Marble Physics, which sounds fun. So have you ever had those wooden tray maze things where you have the little sort of control knobs on the side and it's a maze, you get a steel ball bearing through the thing? That's the idea. No maze in the middle, but it's going to be outputting gates as well as X and Y CV based on a model of a ball bearing flapping about in a square box with walls. Again, I'll wait for some demo, but that's an interesting device. I do quite like the kind of stuff that ADAC come out with. I mean, they've got the sort of heart rate sensing module. They've got that really, really huge mixer as well. I don't think they get quite enough credit for their stuff. But you can check those out if that seems your thing. The more interesting ones, well, the ones that I've actually read up on properly and know more about, we'll go for that battery-related one that I teased earlier. We do know the company MyVolts. They came out with a ripcord a while ago, which allows you to convert USB Type-A ports into DC barrel connectors for guitar pedals, synthesizers, all kinds of musical devices, and they're really cool. You can use those external phone charging power banks quite easily. But they've got a new system, which is a brilliant idea. They call them Revolt. They are little battery-sized doodads, so in AAA, AA, I think then C and D cell-sized cylinders. And they have, I think you buy them as a kit, which has the AAA-sized thing with a really thin ribbon connector ending in a USB port. So you can now USB power normally only battery-powerable devices like pocket operators, Game Boy is an example, and also the Monotrons from Korg. The idea is you have blanks of these little cylinders as well. So you put those into the battery compartment, and in their video you can see them kind of rolling it up. So you've just got a little bit of the cable sticking out on the end and you kind of plug it in. But what a brilliant idea for things like, well, another example here, they've got a cassette player, portable cassette player, if the DC in's broken or it doesn't have one or anything. Super, super cool. There's a good illustration on Synth Anatomy with all of the pictures showing how it all goes together. And it's, yeah, super cool. Great for the small devices if you want to take them out live. But I'm trying to think, what was the last musical device, both of you two chaps, what was the last musical device, or even anything, that had C or D cell batteries?
Not AA. They don't count.
has to be D cells, C or D cells, big chunky ones. There's actually a Heinbach video as well.
The only thing I can think of is the original, the SH-101.
Oh yeah, what's that? Is that C or D or something?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty large batteries. In the battery, I'll have to look.
The juiciest of the synthy boys today, Pete, we were talking about the Deckard's voice last week, I think. But Black Corporation strike again. A Jupiter 8-alike is on the horizon. It does look the business. It's the ISE-NIN. I don't know if that's a Nine Inch Nails reference, but that's the name. Desktop format in the pictures we've got with little wooden end cheeks, but I assume it'll be 19-inch shaped as well. MPE supported and...
Excellent.
Yep. And it's not going for the clone alike because that's boring and Behringer. So they're probably going to go adapted, modernized, but in the spirit of, which is, of course, the best way to go because they're actually putting effort in, like a good synth company. 3,000 to 4,000 euros is the ballpark. Yes. And all of their stuff has got great reviews from the people that have managed to get their hands on the built stuff, so I wouldn't complain if I had the cash to throw around. The eyes have it over in this corner for MPE. What's your MPE experience setup, and why are you such a fan?
I think because I come from a classical background, and where you just got lumps of wood and metal and things, you don't have any kind of clever electronics. But the irony is that if you think about a violin, this just a tiny little box the size of a shoebox made out of lumps of wood and metal, and yet a fractional movement of a single finger or pressure on the bow or a change of attitude or angle of the bow, and the sound is changing simultaneously, multidimensionally. So you can change volume, timbre, pitch, articulation, onset, offset, just by these fractional muscle movements. And one of the things that I whinge a lot in the lectures that I do on control systems with my undergrads and postgrads is that music technology largely, by which we mean digital music electronics, has been a kind of regression in performance control since the early 80s. So if you think about when MIDI comes along and you have an instrument like the Sequential T8, which I'm really proud that I've got one of these things. It's currently up with the legendary James Walker synth repair services being fixed. But this sort of defined the MIDI spec, and where it's measuring not just how hard you hit a note, but how quickly you let the keys go. And you can voice a chord and pull one of the notes out of that as you play. So polyphonic aftertouch. And then a few synths do this throughout the 80s, and then we get to the 90s and suddenly nothing does. And you can't buy one that does it until MPE starts to come along in the noughties with the Hacken and the Lindstrom and so forth. But if you think about classical instruments like the clavichord, sort of 700-year-old instrument, and it's got polyphonic aftertouch. They didn't call it that, they called it beboom. But it's part of the performance of the thing. So I think we've spent a lot of time as digital instrument makers in the 90s and the noughties concentrating on refining sound, which is, of course, extremely important. But it doesn't seem to me that people spend as much time capturing muscle movement, which is another essential part of musical performance. So
excellent.
Anything that lets us do this and lets us perform with our instruments rather than just use... I mean, you know, if you think of the standard kind of MIDI keyboard, I worry how many of those are used essentially as typewriters to get events into logic rather than the capture of a musical performance. Musical stenography is fine, but sometimes not only do you want to hear a performance, but actually it's much quicker to get your fingers creating multiple lanes of expression than it is then to laboriously go back and mouse them in afterwards. So anything that has anything to do with MPE or making sounds more expressive, I'm absolutely all for that. Fantastic.
Wonderful. So over the last, I guess, couple of years, and also being quite handy on the old ivories yourself, I imagine you're quite excited for the Osmos.
Oh, yes. Yes, very.
Even
very
I am, and I can play one song on the piano. It's so cool.
It's extraordinary. I actually emailed them the minute I saw it. I emailed them. They were yeah. incredibly nice. And not only what a wonderful instrument, but I think they've captured something that's really important, and that is the reintegration of MPE-like control into a standard keyboard. So Houghton Continuum's magnificent instrument, the Lindstrom, the Eigenharp. But the only issue with them is that you have, of course, to relearn a technique that it's perhaps taken you 10, 15, 20, 44 years to become proficient with. Whereas if you can take everything that your fingers know, your muscle memory know about the location of black and white notes on a keyboard, but you add that third dimension into it, and a spatial dimension if it's full MPE, then that's something very, very special indeed. So yes, I think that's a remarkable instrument. Also, I think huge recognition also to Andrew McPherson of Touch Keys, who does the kind of retrofit MPE. I don't know if you've seen his stuff.
That's absolutely not familiar to me at all. Do tell.
They're PCBs, actually. So they are PCBs cut into black and white key, you know, natural accidental key shapes that you attach to, retrofit to any existing keyboard. You run a ribble cable from them, from the far end of the keys, you know, furthest away from your fingers, to an interface. And then that goes into a computer. And it measures your XY position per key, and it infers the Z dimension, not from the physical pressure, but from the cross-sectional area of your finger
contact pad. Contact patch, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Maps that into software. You then map those dimensions to whichever sonic dimensions you want. And that effectively gives you retrofitted MPE on your favorite keyboard. And you know,
brilliant,
I think that's an absolutely wonderful idea. And I think Andrew's been making those for, I think it came out of his PhD project, actually. I want to say perhaps 10 years he's been making those. And
excellent. How do we Google for these?
If you go Touch Keys, it should come up.
Touch Keys, expressive multi-touch sensing on the piano.
That's the one.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for letting us know. That is super, super cool. I can think of at least 5 people I need to send this to immediately, but I'll get onto that later. Righty-tighty. Well, that's going to take us to the end of news. And unfortunately, Finn, it's your turn to be interrogated in a friendly way.
Oh, I'm up for that.
Friendly manner. Before we go into the stochastic instruments direction, all three of us, we do have some extent of modular or at least synthesizer performance. And of course, you're a lecturer in the subject, electronic performance and composition. Is that the title?
The course at DBS Music is electronic music production, so EMP. Mm. The specific modules that I head up, I do a part of one on orchestration, I do part of one on electronic music control systems, and then mm-hmm. I also lecture on the masters that we run in innovation in sound. So it's sort of little bits here and there. I used to actually do more at the kind of FE and HE level, but in the last kind of 2 or 3 years, I've spent more of my time kind of running their computer systems in software and just concentrating on the masters and kind of select bits of modules for the undergraduates.
Gotcha. Well, I'm not going to let you dodge the fact that you absolutely know what you're doing, but would you be able to share some highs and lows of your performance experience and potentially any secret sauce top tips for us people performing with unconventional options in the electronic music world?
Well, highs, the thing I did for an old DBS colleague of mine, the great live sound engineer Simon Honeywell, at the Royal William Yard Festival Lights a couple of years ago, again, pre-COVID, then everything stopped. Simon had this concept for a colour organ, so kind of in the sort of Scriabin synesthesia vein, but it was essentially an enormous wall-sized spectrum analyzer. And we set this up in the Royal William Victualling Yard down in Plymouth, where I live down here. And they have these enormous long rope rooms because it was all sort of Napoleonic war, naval port stuff. And it's an incredible, incredible space. And he created this space with a wall of lights behind us. And of course, whatever frequencies you produced, you've got a bar on this enormous light wall lighting up. So he got me to do a piece for that. So I did a kind of half hour semi-improvised piece for that. But I suppose, like lots of modular, you do the homework beforehand and you have a pretty good idea which way the piece is going to go.
Yeah.
You want to leave enough wiggle room on the night to kind of steer things. That was so much fun to do. I mean, not just because it's lovely to be engineered by, well, a world expert like Simon, but also, you know, a really good friend and someone who kind of shares a background in education and all of this sort of stuff. But it was just a really lovely crowd and people were incredibly supportive. And it was one of the first things I sort of did as head sale as well. So that was lovely.
Nice one.
And another one was Superbooth After Party.
Oh, no way. You played it there. Awesome.
Yeah, that was wonderful. That was at Berlin, of course. That was, goodness me, when was that? 2018 or 19. I can't remember which one it was. And that was at Seabase. And if you've ever been to Berlin and you know
the infamous
Seabase.
I've got the thumbnail in my head right now. Yeah.
Which isn't a nightclub and it's not a bar. It is a crashed spaceship. It is very important that we reiterate this point. This was made many times by the people that ran it. And that was incredible fun as well, because it was very nerve-wracking, because of course you're in a room of modular royalty. But that was immensely good fun. That was with my great friend Matt Ward, another colleague at DBS, another huge modular fan, and a brilliant composer and performer and DJ himself as well. So, yeah, wonderful fun.
Are you willing to share times you've crashed and burned?
Oh, God.
And then learned?
Yeah, well, look, that's the most important bit, isn't it? I mean, when something falls over and you think, well, okay, why did it happen? Let's not do that again. I suppose tips, tricks, I kind of always have more leads than you think you need and more connectors and Euro power adapters and all of that sort of stuff. So really simple kind of infrastructure stuff, I think, is probably the most important thing. And be realistic about the size of case you can realistically maneuver onto a small, short haul flight. Because kind of interesting to hear you guys talking about prepping a case. I mean, my case is just below the camera here, and it's 4126, which is, I would say, absolutely on the limit of what you can take on a plane. It's certainly well over the limit of what you can get into hand luggage. But you can buy a ticket for it, which is exactly what I did. So I bought the biggest hard suitcase on wheels I could find. And it goes into that quite nicely. And that works very well on the coach, works very well through the airport. It works less well if you have to go up any stairs, if you have to be escorted to the front of an already very busy, very tired 4 o'clock in the morning flight queue, because it's so big and so heavy, you had to buy a ticket for it, and it has to be appropriately seated so it's not, there are no kids anywhere near it, because if it kind of moves over, it's going to flatten them. So probably the low was, yes, being escorted to the front of a long queue where we absolutely weren't at the front of the long queue.
I'm imagining all those stairs, especially if you're in England and the people who've grown up with queuing as their national pastime.
There was a lot of tutting.
Those looks.
There was a lot of tutting, yes. Because it was England, so no one actually really said anything, but you could certainly feel the atmosphere.
You knew.
Yeah.
You know what you've done.
Yeah. Oh, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Excellent. Another bit that I found on my casual internet stalk, you lead the modular research group. As far as I know, what's one of those when it's at home?
Ah, very kind of you to say I lead it. I mean, it's probably not fair to say I lead it. I vaguely came up with the idea that a lot of us at work were interested in this sort of stuff, and that one of DBS's real core ethoses to teaching is that if we're going to teach, we ought to be doing. And we certainly bring that to everything we do at Further and Higher Education, in terms of, if you like, ordinary practice. So, you know, we're all composers, we're all performers, we do that stuff. But particularly in terms of the innovation side of it, with the master's courses that we teach, I thought it would be very nice if we had a sort of reasonably formalized place where we could take our tinkerings and sort of chew it over with colleagues and students and really anybody who had a good idea and wanted to join. So I will sort of describe it as a very select club with free membership. The only criteria really being that you're interested and you've kind of got an idea and you want to take it forward. And to be honest, that was ultimately where stochastic instruments was born, really, because the idea for the module stochastic came, well, okay, many years ago. I had that when I did an electronics course back in 2009. But the first iteration of stochastic came well before Stochastic Instruments, the company, was formed, and it came out of the modular research group. So it allows us to not only have interested members of staff bring ideas that they've got and they can pitch it to everybody and we can pull it apart and see what works and refine it. But really importantly, students, so that they've got an opportunity to show some of their ideas and get a sense of what it's like to do this stuff. I don't want to say for real, but, you know, at the coalface. And also so that we can make direct connections with industry as well. So it's not just about us inventing stuff or doing stuff. It's also about a formalized place where we can do beta testing for companies, because you make, you know, lovely friends in the modular world. So we did some stuff with Toby from Tubitech, with the MuTune, Alex and Matt from WMD, Stein and Priscilla from This Is Not Rocket Science. So, you know, really good people like that who are doing incredible work and are really friendly and they always want to get involved and do stuff. And again, it's a really nice way for staff and students to kind of network and to be part of the doing of modular and to celebrate the kind of cottage industry thing that modular is, that most of us running these companies are 1, 2, 3 person operations. It's rare that there's a, and I think WMD are probably one of the biggest companies that do it. And again, they're not in terms of the number of people. It's not Roland, Korg or Yamaha. You know, it's small groups of people doing, with the agility to do incredible, innovative things. And I think that's enormously exciting. That's what, I suppose if you think about it, that's what Korg, Roland, Yamaha were in the 60s and 70s. The MRG is a sort of formalized playground where we can bring those strands, the educational strand, the innovation strand, the making and doing strand, and the networking strand together. And yeah, I'm really pleased with how it's worked out. And we've had a riot doing it, and long may it continue.
Well, it sounds absolutely amazing. And thank you. That was a brilliant answer to that question.
Thank you very much.
You've already sort of preempted a couple of my next ones, but I'm going to stick to my order because I'm stubborn or something. I'm a big fan of weird sequences, possibly just for a horrible lack of talent. But do you have any favourites that you haven't designed? So other designs, just odd sequences, or if not a sequencer, just modules or synth devices that have just surprised you, made you smile, that kind of thing.
Oh, well, okay, well, if we start with sequences, I mean, Eloy from Winter Modular, the Eloquencer, was a sort of instant classic. I just think it's a magnificent piece of design. It's, I said before, I'm from a classical background, so the way I organise my rack is all of my sequences that are the closest row to me. So that's my keyboard. And then the next row away are my oscillators and filters. Those are the quote-unquote, the sort of the instrument bits. I should say the sound-making bits. Then as I kind of, the next row are the control voltage sort of manglers. And then the final row furthest away are the mixers and the overall filters and the you know, the mastering output kind of stuff. Interestingly, almost the complete opposite of my friend Matt, who comes from a DJing tradition, and because he's much more used to sort of, you know, crossfading, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Delighted to say he has a stochastic closest to him. But then right next to that, he's got his WMD performance mixer on his closest row, whereas mine's at my sort of top left. Yeah, the Eloquencer, I think, is a magnificent pre-composing kind of sequencer. So if you've got something where, you know, you've really carefully designed a series of hooks and riffs and things, its UI is fantastic. It's got just the right amount of probabilistic variation in it. It's incredibly powerful for what it does. It's really compact. Yeah, love it. I love the Variegate 8 and the voltage block from Maleco.
A good pairing, that one.
Really beautiful. They're sort of more immediate, more organic. Of course, you can use voltage block for pitches, but I think it plays beautifully with something like the Basimilus, where you can assign multiple lanes to multiple timbre parameters. And that can be, again, really, really, really musical. If you watch someone like another Superbooth friend, Derek Basic, he's a maestro on something like voltage block and Basimilus. You know, extraordinary percussion work he gets out of that. Rene, of course, I think is wonderful. and WMD's Metron.
Is that the sort of a newer sequencer? I can't quite remember it.
Metron on its own is a 16-track trigger sequencer, so particularly designed for triggering on-off events, so drum voices and so forth. So if you're in the rather luxurious position of having a dedicated kind of drum row or drum case, having a Metron at the centre of that, for example, is just an incredibly powerful percussion-centred, or perhaps I should say event-centred way of doing a sequencing. But then, of course, I think it's Volterra, the add-ons, the four-track CV add-ons to that. So a fully expanded Metron can give you 16 channels of CV control as well. So that's kind of, I suppose for me, it perhaps sits somewhere between the Variegate and the Eloquencer in terms of a kind of pre-compositional, pre-planned kind of approach with the Eloquencer to a sort of organic, get your fingers involved kind of thing with the voltage block. The Metron and Volterra sits very nicely between those two. So, all of those I just think are wonderful. Further afield, kind of non-sequencing. Well, I mean, Toby's MuTune is the sort of functional centre of my rig. I suppose, again, because of the classical background, having the access to non-12-tone temperament tuning, I think, is great. It's not just the microtonality stuff that it gives you. I mean, the CV, so pitch masking, so 8 channels of quantization. Really simple but incredibly useful things like auto-triggering. So whenever it detects a change in voltage, it pings out a trigger. Just something like that is incredibly useful. Leydig stuff, I think, is wonderful. I mean, I use their comparator and their derivator and median. Some of those for just voltage mangling, I think, is great stuff. 4MS, spectral multiband resonator, I think, is a great module.
Big fan here.
Wonderful. You mentioned Chaos earlier. Batumi, I think, is...
Ooh, Pete's ears perked up. He's contemplating Batumi's. One of those.
Oh, they're wonderful. They are so, so, so useful. Lots of very elegantly... I don't want to say hidden. I suppose that's the wrong word. But elegantly second-functioned abilities that it has is beautifully done. And then probably the last one is my kind of triple output triumvirate of mastering modules. So the WMD performance mixer, Muscle, their compressor, and Overseer, their bus filter, high-pass, low-pass bus filter. I mean, those are so staple to kind of conditioning everything in the case. I mean, you know, because I suppose my background is much more compositional than it is sound engineering. One of the things I have to work very hard at, because I'm much less good at it, is the sonic management. So, you know, frequency management and not swamping everything with a kick and getting things nicely pumping through a compressor, all of that sort of output bus stuff. And the thing that strikes me with WMD's stuff is it is so absolutely focused on performance from the absolute get-go on the drawing board. I know that all of the guys there are out playing 3-4 times a week, and you can just see that every single decision they've made has started from the question of what do I need it to do playing it. And it's right there in the design. It's immediate. It's in front of you. It sounds great. They've given you just the right amount of control over it, so that there's nothing that it doesn't do that you wish it did, but also you're not swamped with having 10 different, fractionally different variations where you really just want one knob you can turn because it's a 4:30 in the morning set and you just need something to happen now and you don't have the plates left to spin to work out how to do it. So, yeah, WMD stuff I think is wonderful. Absolutely.
Always nice to have the practical options in a thoroughly impractical performance system. But we do love it.
Yes, exactly.
Allow me to eloquently frame the next question. For those who haven't heard of you or Stochastic Instruments, when, how, where, Omsonic, what now?
The birth of Stochastic Instruments is sort of inextricably bound with the birth of Stochastic and the kind of production of Stochastic, the module itself. I did, as part of some CPD many years ago, an electronics course. And it's one of the kind of two things I recommend anybody who is into electronic music do is, number one, learn an acoustic instrument, piano or anything, but, you know, just have enough finger skills and theoretical skills, because it really helps you. You don't have to use it. You don't have to be kind of conditioned by that way of doing things, but it's a really good idea to know about that stuff. And number two, learn some electronics or learn some coding, or preferably both. Because the thing I found when I started to learn to code, but also when I started to learn electronics, was there's almost not a thing you'll learn that you won't see as having an immediate application in the music that you do. And I just remember sitting in lecture after lecture, loving being a student again and learning stuff, but also seeing applications from just absolutely I'm not saying middle of the road theory, just generally applicable theory, how those could be applied to ideas I'd had about composition or workflow when I'm composing or performing. And one of the ideas that I kind of scribbled on the back of my notes was the idea of, why is it that we think of sequences as fixing the sequence of events and parameterizing the pitch of those events? So we always go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way up to 16 and back to 1. And that's just assumed. The thing you parameterize is the pitch of each one of those. I kind of had this idea of flipping that around so that actually the route through them wasn't fixed, but the pitches actually were. And what you were setting was the likelihood that the next pitch would be whatever it would be. And you did that probabilistically, so that rather than fixing the route through variable pitches, you parameterized the route through fixed pitches. And at the time that I had the idea, this was kind of before that would have been feasible to do on the small-scale fabrication stuff that is now the beating heart of Eurorack. You can design a PCB on a laptop, have it fabricated, it be back on your doorstep in 2 weeks, and you can proto very, very quickly that way. You just couldn't do that back then. So we looked at doing it in analog, but it would have been huge and not really feasible. I wrote it in Python in 2014, and that was a sort of MIDI version. I was really surprised by how well that worked. We had it, my friend Chris Pratt, he lent me his Dope for Dre Bank, and that did all of the controls on it. And I was really pleased by how that worked. But again, it still wasn't really feasible to get that up and running. But then partially through the MRG, partially through a student of mine who runs still OMSonic, Fenn Marks, we thought, well, look, maybe we can actually do that now. And this was whenever that was, kind of 2019, I suppose. And so the first iteration of Stochastic happened as a collaboration between the MRG and me and DBS and Fenn's company, OMSonic, who for, I suppose, at least two or three years at that stage had been manufacturing, you know, really lovely oscillators, filters, kind of conventional East Coast kind of stuff, but done really beautifully. Lovely circuit designs, lovely sounds. And I think this was probably more or less the first digital circuit that OMSonic had done. Because as I say, it's not really feasible to do something like Stochastic in analog. You could do, but it would be very big. It's much more sensible to put it on a chip and do it in firmware. And I found, almost by accident actually, Stuart McVeigh at Plymouth University. And we had our sort of first chat by the phone, and I kind of explained what I needed it to do. And Stuart, who is not a musician actually, his specialty is power transformer design. Although he is a mean ballroom dancer. I sort of explained what it needed to Stuart, and in about a ridiculously short amount of time, he'd assimilated all of the sort of, not just the kind of music theory ideas, but the more esoteric John Cagean probabilistic approaches that some of us use in electronic music. He'd really kind of got to grips with that, or done a version of the basic algorithm that I'd written in Python. And we had a proto really very quickly, actually. And then there was a period of a few months just sort of integrating all of the layers that I'd wanted it to do into second functionality, deciding on what the most performably compact footprint we could get that in. So that, you know, you hadn't got this thing where you've got to have tiny little fingers to operate it, but at the same time, it's not taking up a huge amount of real estate, so that it gives you the option to have more conventional approaches to pre-composed sequencing close by as well. A form factor that kind of worked, a navigable second and tertiary function kind of system, and all of the beta testing stuff you have to do to make sure it doesn't brick. We eventually got to manufacturing. I think that was the point where we had just underestimated the amount of demand for it, really. People seemed to go crazy for it. We did a Sonic State interview with the wonderful Nick Batt for the home edition of Superbooth. And I think it was just something that was between OMSonic's kind of own homebrew designs. It was just something that we couldn't get out fast enough to meet the demand that we had. So at some point, I suppose towards the end of 2020, I spoke to Fenn and I said, look, perhaps the way forward actually is for us to sort of make a company out of this module. And Fenn was more than happy to do that, and because it gives him the freedom to concentrate on it. His OMSonic stuff is doing really well. And so I then contacted Stuart again, who was originally really just on a single contract just to do the firmware for this. And I said, look, what do you think? Should we make a whole company out of this? And wonderfully, he said, yes, let's do it. And we set up over a sort of very busy Christmas holiday. So designing websites and sending emails back and forth over sort of nut roasts, Christmas lunch, and so forth. And we set the company up. Wasn't quite the 1st of January. I think it was the 4th of January this year we set it up. And, of course, the first job was clearing that long waiting list, which we really pleased to say we're very close to doing that now. Then it goes on public sale. So it's been great to see the emails still coming in. People are saying, look, we love this. When can we buy it? Every time we get one of those, I sort of say, look, thank you very much. We're going to honour the Omsonic list first, and you're on the list. And so, yeah, here we are, a folder full of future ideas that have kind of been rattling around in my head for a few years. At the moment, it sort of seems like a one product company, I suppose, because it is centered around this one product. But the real ethos of Stochastic Instruments, the company, comes from what I wanted to do with Stochastic Inspiration Generator, the module. And that is the hinterland between what conventional instruments are fantastic at doing, which is the performance. And what I was saying when we were talking about MPE, so capturing muscle movements and expression through what your fingers are doing, on the one hand. But then on the other hand, what Eurorack is fantastic at doing, which is process. So the idea that, I suppose because of my sort of science background, I adore these sort of probabilistic ideas and how maths can be applied to a musical composition. But because of my sort of dual citizenship as a science musician, the musician side of me isn't quite satisfied with just setting a process into being and just then becoming an audience member and observing it, because I want to get my hands in there and sort of get dirty. But on the other hand, why make a modular system try to be a piano or try to be a violin or try to be a guitar when those instruments have survived for hundreds and hundreds of years and are absolutely fantastic at what they do, the sort of muscle performance stuff? So what I really wanted to do was to find something that would satisfy me as a composer and a performer, that would allow me to perform a process so that I didn't feel this was a kind of poor emulation of a piano, but at the same time, I didn't feel that I was just pressing play on an equation that would then just run its course and but my job was then over. So that's the real ethos of the SIG, the Inspiration Generator. But it's also what we want to do as a company with the other designs we've got in the bag. Right.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That's incredible encapsulation from the vaguest of questions. If we can backtrack just a teeny tiny tad, we have some real stunning brains at the ModCaf. I'm not one of them, absolutely. We have Akira, who we interviewed prior, who's just incredible with unconventional composition methods and jumping into pure data and Max for Live, that kind of thing. That's, you know, there's that whole left brain, right brain, certain type of creative thing that I don't understand. And we also have the creator of the Wasp clone, Jasper Synth Wasp clone, is in our circle. So we have both halves of what you were alluding to, the coding or electronics. Learn one because it'll be amazing. For people already one foot in, so to say, what might the pathway look like from, here's an idea, it's module flavoured. What might the pathway be from that state of mind to Pete over there holding his Stochastic Inspiration Generator in his hands? The nitty-gritty stuff, the obviously you've got to have some kind of virtual working model, probably, or you could breadboard it, all the way through to fabrication and selling it to some guy on the internet somewhere.
Wow, what a great question.
But obviously that could be horribly open-ended, so maybe we can squeeze it a little bit.
Firstly, have your antenna out so that you're reading and listening to everything to soak up the possibilities of those ideas. Because, I mean, there are no new ideas. Mozart was doing probabilistic music with dice rolls, but coming up with an interesting idea in terms of just reading as much as you can, but then getting your grubby thumbprints on it, I think is a really good thing to do. But I mean, that's just the generation of the idea. Supposing you've had an idea, what do you do? Well, I suppose being realistic about what you can achieve with your skill set in that time, in the time you have available, so that you should know that if you've never done coding before, you've never done electronics before, the likelihood of you on your own personally getting that out there to market in an appreciable amount of time is going to be tricky to do. But crucially, having enough knowledge of the kinds of problems that you're going to encounter so that you can then communicate your idea from your musician's brain to a technician's brain. So, you know, the conversation, for example, I had to have with Stuart over the phone, not having met him, where he's a non-musician, but a brilliant, brilliant embedded systems designer, and me, where I've got just enough coding, just enough electronics to kind of explain how the algorithm would work, so that he's then, or she's then, got enough information to go and do a first draft. Because it's that lost in translation thing that takes the time up. The reason I say it's a great idea to learn some coding and also some electronics, number one, yes, because it's going to suggest ideas to you, but number two, because the skills at communicating it to somebody with the necessary skill set to do that is going to cut at least weeks, plural, probably much longer, out of the process of developing that idea. Because the smarter the questions you ask them, the smarter the answers they will give back. And those answers will refine your design. I don't know how many of the aspects to stochastic were infinitely improved just by Stuart asking me really tough questions that I hadn't really thought about. And he said, well, okay, look, fine. That idea is great. That idea is that great. That idea is great. What happens if all three happen at the same time, randomly? And I hadn't thought about that. So that's actually where a lot of the TREG idea, you know, the envelope outputs that it has, a lot of that came out of tough questions from Stuart, forcing me to refine the ideas in my head. So, yeah, just having enough knowledge to ask a useful question of your collaborators, I think, is a fantastically useful bit of advice.
Excellent. And on the more slightly boring practical business side, getting the thing built, ordering PCBs, do you make it yourself? Do you get it populated somewhere? What's that kind of stuff like?
Well, we're all in the middle of a semiconductor drought at the moment.
That's a lovely spanner to have at the current time, isn't it?
It's absolutely splendid. I suppose that's one of the curveballs that the universe is going to throw you. And I'm not going to say there's nothing you can do about that, because certainly making sure that you are thinking certainly weeks, and I would suggest months ahead in terms of the availability of the bits that you're likely to need. That's a useful bit of advice. In terms of the pure manufacturing, I mean, the way we do it at the moment is that the PCBs and the surface mount aspects of it. So if you think about the big-sized components that we're sort of used to seeing on old circuit boards, so resistors and capacitors and things, basically anything that you can easily pick up in your fingers, that tends to be through hole, so the legs go through the holes in a circuit board, and the surface mount stuff tend to be absolutely minute, like grain of rice-sized, and they sit on the surface of the circuit board. And what we do is we have the surface mount stuff done by our fabricators, and they are then sent to us for completion by Stuart with the through-hole component. So those are typically all of the controls, so the sliders and the knobs and things. We found that to work actually very well. I know that lots of different manufacturers use that technique. Slightly bigger manufacturers are able to do everything in-house with pick-and-place machines, so effectively robots that will drop the components onto a circuit board and then heat them up so that they solder in place and so forth. But of course, for small, like micro startups like us, there's a big cash outlay involved in getting equipment like that. So, again, it's a very luxurious position to be in to be able to start off like that. So I suspect that most people will follow the route that we did, where you use out-of-house surface mount manufacture, and then you do the stuff you can do yourself in-house.
At the risk of going on forever, I must have a last question, which will happen now, but we might have to get you back to keep going. You've been an absolutely stunning guest. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful.
You hinted earlier that there is some secret sauce, but what, if you can tell us anything or give the vaguest of vague hints, what's next in the SI catalog horizon thing?
Well, as they say, I would love to tell you, but then I would have to kill you. We've got quite a lot of ideas, some in terms of physical size, some bigger, some smaller, HP-wise. One that we would like to do is to revisit Strange, which was one of the ones that we did with OmSonic, or I did with OmSonic, actually. It was before Stuart was involved. So I can imagine an update to Strange before too long. Yeah, I am absolutely bursting to tell you, but I really can't, because the trouble is, it's because of clearing the list. We really want to be so careful to balance honouring the promises to people who've been so good to kind of believe in the product and bear with us while we went through all of these delays to get it out. And therefore, it would be really unfair to kind of prioritize that stuff over and above getting these out. As we get to the end of the list, the scales can start to tip.
Tip but the other way, of course.
What I will say is it's definitely not a one product company. There is definitely going to be more of this coming. And we are, I think we'll leave it there.
Excellent. Well, we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled. And I'm sure we'll also have some auditory delights once Pete has brought his Castic Inspiration Generator out into the wild, potentially into a strange forest somewhere with a bunch of weirdos from the Modular Cafe, but it'll be delicious when it happens. We must conclude with our miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. Finn, if you have any recommendations to how to add more M's and alliteration into that segment, feel free, because it's not elegant at all, but it's unfortunately stuck for 50-odd episodes. I'll go first, because I don't actually have that much to say about it, because I haven't finished watching it yet, because I wanted to sit back and appreciate properly. I came across a channel, which I can't remember the name of, so I'm just going to scroll down on the page. In-depth cine, I assume, not sign, C-I-N-E, in-depth cine. I'm not a big film buff. I don't watch any of the sort of super weird, obscure stuff and get all arty-farty about it, but I do like a good film. And I do work for a video production company, and I also know very little about how to film things, which is probably a problem. Anyway, I found a video called Don't Touch the Fish, Why Student Films Fail. So it's a monologue-ish thing with examples. Footage from, I assume, the creator's experience as well as standout indie films, that kind of stuff. Sort of basics of, you know, getting a film made, so any kind of motion picture really, and the pitfalls and how to translate, ooh, we've got this great idea, we've got a narrative, and how to make it not suck. It's been very interesting for the half of what I've watched, so I'm going to check out more of that channel. In-depth cine on YouTube, C-I-N-E for that last word. And Don't Touch the Fish, Why Student Films Fail. Who wants to go next? Pete, you've been quiet for a while.
All right.
Hello, there he is. What have you got for us?
Right, as per normal from me, it's a YouTube channel.
Always the way.
One that's popped up in my YouTube stream on occasions, and I've generally ignored, but I thought I'd give it a little bit of a go and realised it's quite a little treasure, to be honest. Now, the channel is entitled Fran Blanche. I don't know if any of you guys have come across it.
No bells here.
No.
Fran is a self-described geek girl, but she also goes on to say lifetime underachiever and world record holder in a list of also-rans. Also, strangely, a senior member of the Institute of Electronic and Electronic Engineers.
Our kind of nerd, then.
Absolutely.
So her channel involves all sorts of things. There's a heavily biased towards electronics and various electronic projects, but also she does other more esoteric bits and pieces. I mean, the one that initially caught my eye, she did a whole piece on one of the it wasn't a full size, it's a smaller version, but it's an actual plate reverb that she owns.
Ah, nice.
And she does a whole description of its functionality, which is quite interesting, and cracks the thing open. I mean, it's literally, I would say it's about 5 feet high, maybe about 3 feet wide, and maybe a foot, 18 inches deep. It's a big old thing, and I believe that's a small one. From what I mean, I've never really seen a plate reverb in the flesh. I've always used either emulations or plugins, to be honest. Anyway, she sort of describes the history of the particular one that she owns in the respect of when they were made, when they were available, some of the history of the one that she has, and then also demonstrates its functionality. And she basically implores that it's the best Echo that she thinks was on the market. One of the sort of real old school stuff. So brilliant. But there's many other bits and pieces. Her channel's actually blown up just recently because she made some comment on the UFO declarations that have come out of the Pentagon in the last few months, I want to say, or weeks. And that particular episode suddenly went to 1.5 million views, which is, I think it's taken her by surprise, because on average she gets between, looking at it, maybe 10 to 20, maybe 40,000 views normally. So that particular one has projected a channel into all sorts of strange areas that she's not used to, because she has been going for about 10 years or so. And notably, I think she might have had some involvement with one of Adam Savage's projects that he did demonstrated on the Tested channel as well, because there's some bits and pieces here. And I don't think she was just a passive viewer. I think she might have had some involvement. Anyway, so that's my recommendation for this week, Fran Blanche.
Excellent. I've absolutely added that plate reverb to my watch later. I can't wait to get stuck in on there.
Me too. Right. That's fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. Finn, take it away. Round us off for the, evening for us.
Mine has an M in it. It doesn't begin with M. Ah. It's Ikutaro Kakahashi's An Age Without Sample. Sorry, it's a book. I don't know. Do they count? I suppose they do.
It is a form of media.
It is.
And it's probably available on Kindle in some form, so it can be digital. Anyway.
Kakahashi, of course, was the now sadly late CEO of Roland, and together with Dave Smith, created the MIDI spec for which they were joint awarded the technical Emmy a few years ago. And I suppose it's kind of his autobiography. But it's also a really interesting kind of, not quite a polemic, but a really interesting kind of long-form argument for exactly those kinds of performance things we were talking about right at the beginning. So it actually rather rounds things off quite nicely because, you know, he's coming at it from ultimately ending up being a synth designer's and a company CEO's perspective, but really understanding his position, I suppose our shared position, as inheriting the mantle from the instrument designers that sort of went before us. And again, how important the idea of physicality in performance is. And so he does a really good job of not bashing you over the head with that idea, because you go through the setup of Roland and sort of home organ design and drum machine design. And then it, of course, goes through the SH-101 and the Jupiter 8 that we were talking about. But he develops a really, really good argument for where he thought, I think right at the end of his life, I think this was published pretty much the year that he died, where he thought and where he thinks digital instrument design should be headed. And I haven't quite finished it. I suppose I've got about a tenth or an eighth left to finish. But it's lovely to get a feeling that someone of that stature is still thinking about instruments in the same way that, I don't know, Cristofori was thinking about them when he invented the piano in 1700 or so. So, fantastic read. An Age Without Samples by Ikutaro Kakahashi.
Excellent. I'll have to put that one on my list as well. Listeners, my colleagues, it's been an absolute pleasure. Farewell!